Okay. Welcome, everyone. My name is Tzvi Benoff. I'm the rabbinic assistant. I'll be filling in for Rabbi Robinson this week. Are people over Zoom able to hear me? The audio works? All right. So this week's parsha is Parshas Balak. Now, Balak occurs immediately after Parshas Chukas. Last week, we read Parshas Chukas, and the Parsha ends, and chronologically, Parshas Balak follows immediately. Sometimes, in between one Parsha to another, there's maybe a few months, or even a couple of centuries. This week's Parsha happens immediately after Parshas Chukas ends. So how did Parshas Chukas end? Yeah. Oh, sure. Is this better? Okay. All right, awesome. So Parshas Chukas ended with the Jewish people fighting against two kings, Sichon and Og. They controlled all of the Amori territory. This was in the Transjordan area, modern-day Jordan and Syria. The Jewish people were marching into the land of Israel, and before they did, they encountered these hostile nations. The Amori region was ruled by two kings, Sichon and Og. And so at the end of last week's parsha, the Jewish people had defeated, they had killed Sichon and Og, they had conquered the territory in the Transjordan area, and they were now about to enter another territory that lay between them and the land of Israel, the land of Moab. Now, Moab was ruled by the king Balak, where our Parsha gets its name from. And so the Parsha opens up with saying, Vayar Balak. Balak saw what the Jewish people had done to Sichon and Og, how they had completely eradicated their armies, how they had killed the kings. And Balak grew afraid, and he called to his friend and confidant, Bilam, who was a prophet who could communicate with God. And he asked Bilam to go and curse the Jewish people. Bilam, even though he was a wicked person, he had a power of prophecy. He was able to communicate with God. And his blessings and curses had an impact. And so Balak asked Bilam, please go curse the Jewish people. Hopefully I will be able to defeat them. So Bilam agrees. And then the rest of the parsha is Bilam trying to curse the Jewish people. And God time and time again proving that Bilam cannot do something against the will of God. God told him, don't curse the Jews. Bilam tried anyway. And so God always turned his blessings into curses. So I think in order to understand what sort of Bilam's plan was, because it's a little weird. Hashem told Bilam, don't curse the Jewish people. It's not going to work. Nevertheless, Bilam, who could communicate with God, said, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to try to prove God wrong. Now, it wasn't as if Bilam was trying to do something that worked around God. Bilam's entire power came from God. And nevertheless, Bilam said, even though God told me not to do it, I'm going to use God's own power against him. Now, to you and me, or at least to myself, that sounds a little bit ludicrous. It sounds a little bit weird how Bilam could think to use God's own power against the will of God. And so to understand what Bilam's rationale was, I think the best way to do it is to actually go back to last week's Parsha. We're going to take a look at an episode in last week's Parsha, the fight against Og, which is only three psukim long. It's only three verses long. And yet the Talmud and the Medrash make it a much bigger story and a much more fantastic one. So the story of the Jewish people fighting against Og is, as I said, it's three verses long. There's not much there. All the Torah tells us is that the Jewish people went to Og's territory, to the land of Bashan, And the Jewish people, and particularly Moshe, were afraid. They were afraid to go fight him. And so God tells them, don't be afraid. God told Moshe, don't be afraid. You will be victorious. That's verse 2. Verse 3, it works. The Jewish people are victorious, and Moshe kills Og. That's the end of the story. Verse 1 says they encountered Og. Verse 2 says they were afraid, and Hashem told them, don't be afraid. And verse 3 shows us that they were victorious, and Og was killed. If you see in your source sheets, though, source number 1, the Gemara in Brachos tells us a much more expansive story. And it's really interesting. So if you look at the top picture, I'm going to share the screen now so people on Zoom can also see it. Give me 1 second. There we go. So if you look at the top, there's a picture. This is an 18th century drawing by some Islamic artist. And it depicts the giant demon Og attempting to kill Moshe and the Jewish people with a mountain. So where does this painting come from? The Torah doesn't talk about it. So it actually comes from the Gemara. If you look in source number 1, there's a Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos tells us that if we see the rock that Og wanted to throw on the Jewish people, you're supposed to make a blessing. You're supposed to thank God for making miracles and saving the Jewish people. And the Gemara asks, how do I know that this entire episode occurred? It doesn't say it in the Torah. And the Gemara says, you're right. It doesn't say it in the Torah. It is an oral tradition that was passed down from generation to generation. And the story goes as follows. Og said, how big is the Jewish people's camp? It's 3 parsangs long. Whatever that translates into, it was a pretty large area. Probably about 16,000 square feet. Much, much more than that. No, I'm sorry. It's 4,000 feet by 4,000 feet. So it would be 160,000 square feet. And Og was a giant. So Og said, don't worry, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to uproot a mountain and I'm going to throw it over the Jewish people's encampment and I'll crush them. And even if I don't kill all of them, I'll kill most of them. And then it'll be really easy to defeat the rest of them. And that's what he tried to do. Og went, he uprooted a mountain. Again, according to the Gemara and the Medrash, he was a giant. So he uprooted it and he lifted it over his head. And so God performed a miracle. So if I were God, what I would have done is, the easiest thing to do is, well, the mountain will just fall on top of him and he'll die. Pretty easy. But God didn't do that. He sort of went halfway. So the Holy One, blessed be he, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God brought a bunch of ants. It's a little unclear what it is. Some say it was ants, some say it was grasshoppers, depends how you translate it. But these insects came and they hollowed out the mountain. And so by hollowing it out, it fell on Og's head. Then, once it fell on Og's head, Og wanted to take it off of his head. So God did another miracle. God made Og's teeth elongate. And they became like tusks. They elongated into the rock itself. And so it was stuck on his head and he was immobilized. May explain this from a pasuk. And so now that Og is immobilized, Moshe was able to engage Og in one-on-one combat. Moshe was about 20 feet tall. He took an axe that was 20 feet tall and he jumped another 20 feet. And he was able to hit Og's ankle. He stabbed him. He slashed him with the axe. And because Og was immobilized, Og toppled over and he died. So this is an amazing story. This is an incredible story. It's really hard to believe. In fact, the Rashba, who was one of the greatest rabbis of all time, we use him almost every day to understand Gemara, to understand Halacha. He also, in addition to writing many, many commentaries to the Talmud and Responsa, he was also a Kabbalist. And in addition to all of that, he wrote a commentary to Agados, to the homiletic parts of the Talmud. And he writes that this is not meant to be literal. This story is not meant to be literal. It is supposed to be a metaphor. So now we have to ask ourselves, okay, if this was a metaphor, it's a really bizarre metaphor. Why would the Gemara, why would the Talmud write this metaphor in such a weird way? God has a lot of different ways to kill people. God has a lot of different ways to save the Jewish people. Why did he create this like really bizarre way? Okay, it's one thing that the mountain fell on top of Og. Okay, Og tried to kill the Jewish people with a mountain, so God made the mountain fall on him. Okay, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. But God didn't do that. God went through all these intermediary steps. He had insects come and hollow it out, and then he made Og's teeth grow bigger, and only then, when he was paralyzed, could Moshe come and defeat him. So why go through all of that? It seems really weird. And again, if it's a metaphor, why did we describe the Jewish people's threat by being crushed by a mountain? Could have been a lot of other things. Og could have stepped on them. Og could have kicked them away. Og could have done a lot of things. So why specifically threatening to throw a mountain on them? So I'd love to hear your suggestions. If anybody has any, please, I'd love to hear. As a hint, right below this Gemara, I'll scroll down to this on the computer screen, there are two pictures. On the left is Og. This is from a kid's book. On the left is Og threatening to crush the Jewish people with a mountain, and you see Moshe with his axe. And then to the right is another episode with the Jewish people and a mountain. Exactly. Har Sinai. This is eerily similar to what happened at Har Sinai when the Jewish people received the Torah. I'm just curious, do any of you know a potential threat that happened when the Jewish people are at Har Sinai? Exactly, yeah. So it's a Rashi. The Rashi is based on a Gemara in Shabbos. It's on the next page. The Gemara in Shabbos quotes a pasuk from Yisro, from Parshas Yisro, that the Jewish people stood b'tachtis ha'har. Now, the simple interpretation is they stood at the foot of the mountain. But the literal translation is that they stood beneath the mountain. So what does that mean? The Gemara says that God lifted up the mountain over their heads, and he said, if you accept the Torah, great. If not, it'll crush you. So it would seem that the symbolism is that Og is trying to reenact Matan Torah, only this time with the unhappy ending. Og is trying to use the weight of Sinai to crush the Jewish people. Now, if you say that, that opens up a whole other Pandora's box of questions. But most prominently, it might explain why Moshe was the one that engaged Og in single-person combat, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was the one that brought down the Torah, so Moshe was the one that fought Og. But what was Og thinking? It didn't work last time. The Jewish people survived last time. They weren't crushed by the mountain then. So why would Og think it would be different now? Why would Og think that he could be different and he could harness the power of Har Sinai, the power of the Torah against the Jewish people, if it didn't work last time? Yeah.
May I?
One moment. I'm sorry?
To answer that.
Okay, yeah, so that's one suggestion. One possibility is that the Jewish people had sinned. The Jewish people had worshipped the golden calf. They had listened to the report of the spies. They had messed up. And so perhaps they were no longer worthy of doing it. They showed that they weren't interested in accepting the Torah. And so maybe Og could use that against them. I'm sorry, somebody on Zoom. Can you unmute again and say your suggestion?
My thought is that it was a parallel because, in fact, in one case where it should have been a blessing that they, even if they were threatened with the mountain, there was something good to be had, whereas Og was taking it around and making a threat to the people.
Yeah, I think that's a great parallel to this week's parsha as well, right? Bilam was trying to harness God's power of blessing and turn it into a curse against the Jewish people. And God proved that, no, you can't do that. Og was trying to do a similar thing. Og was trying to harness the power of the Torah and turn it around and use it against the Jewish people. And I think the best way to understand this type of rationale is to see that this is actually not the first time that Og did a good thing with ulterior motives. It's not on the sheet, but does anybody know of any other point where Og did something, an ostensibly good thing, with ulterior motives? It happened in Sefer Bereishis. Yeah. Yeah,
we
exactly.
We can't hear the person talking. We can only hear you.
I'll repeat what the person is saying. I'm sorry. So that is correct. That Og, according to the Medrash, appeared in Sefer Bereishis when Lot moved to the city of Sodom, and the city was overrun by the four kings, and he was taken captive. The Torah says, Vayavo ha-palit el Avraham, or Avram at the time, that the palit, the fugitive, came and told Avraham that his nephew Lot had been captured. So who was that palit? Who was that refugee? So the fugitive, the Medrash says, was Og. The Medrash tells us that this was Og. And it says that even though he did a good thing, he actually had ulterior motives. He wanted Avraham to be killed, and so he could marry Sarah. And nevertheless, the Medrash says that God rewarded Og for his deed in the merit of telling Avraham about the capture of his nephew. Og merited an obscenely long life. He lived till the time that the Jews were in the desert. And he was able to have a huge kingdom. He was able to rule the entire land of Bashan, which was a very fertile land for grazing sheep. And so the Gemara tells us that that was why Moshe was afraid. Moshe was afraid that Og had this great merit. It might not seem like a great merit because he had ulterior motives, but apparently, according to God, this was a pretty good thing. He had saved Lot's life. He had warned Avraham. And because of that, he merited to live hundreds of years and to be king of a huge kingdom. And so Moshe was afraid that the Jewish people would not be able to defeat Og. And so Hashem said, don't worry. When Og tries to use the power of Matan Torah against you, it's not going to work. And that, of course, begs the question then. Well, why is this time different than the last time? Both times, Og was trying to harness the power of something. The power of something ostensibly good for his own purposes. And yet, nevertheless, even though it worked the first time around, it didn't work when he tried to reenact Matan Torah. And in fact, I'll give you, before we answer that, I'll give you one more episode in the Medrash where we see Og doing this again. And I think that will help shed light on it. The Medrash asks, why was Og referred to as the Palit? How do we know that when it tells us Vayavo ha-palit, that the fugitive or the refugee came, that it's referring to Og? How do I know that that's what it means? So it says ha-palit, the fugitive or the refugee, depending on how you translate it. It's referring to somebody who had escaped in the past. Og was actually thousands of years old. The Medrash says that he survived the Mabul, the great flood in the time of Noah. Now, Og was not allowed onto the ark. He was not allowed onto the Teva. And so the Medrash tells us that he came to Noah and he said, I can't get in the ark, but I'm going to hang on to the outside of it and give me food. And if you do that, I'll be your servant and I'll be your descendant's servants. And that's what the Medrash says. That's what happened. Noah allowed Og to hang on to the top. He allowed Og to hang on to the edge, like the bow, if you will, the railing of the ark. He drilled a little hole into the side, hopefully above the water line, and he passed food and water out to Og, and that's how Og survived. Now, again, this is not meant to be taken literally, but what is the imagery here? Og survived by hanging on to the periphery. He wasn't allowed into the Teva. He wasn't allowed into the Ark. Now, again, the Ark was built according to the specifications of God. If God wanted Og in the Ark, he could have just told Noah, make a bigger Ark. Or to have all of the animals fit in the Ark anyway was miraculous. So God could have made a miracle and Og could have fit in even though he was pretty big. It would seem then that Og wasn't supposed to be in the Ark. God didn't want Og in the Ark. Why? Because he wasn't a good person. And yet, nevertheless, he survived by playing along, by hanging on to the periphery of what the Ark symbolized, of the goodness, by pledging his allegiance to Noach and what Noach stood for. And because of that, he was able to survive. The Torah is a rule book. If you follow the rules, we believe that you get rewarded. And if you don't follow the rules, we believe that you get punished. So Og, unlike many of the other people at that time, he recognized that there was a God and he recognized that there was a rule book. And he realized that if you follow the rules, you get rewarded. And if you don't follow the rules, you get punished. But Og didn't want to serve God. He wanted to serve himself. So the best way to do that was to follow the rules. But if you just follow the rules, but you don't sort of buy into the vision, then you can't make it into the Ark. You can only exist on the periphery. You can only exist by hanging on. Because in fact, the Torah is much more than a rule book. The Torah is God's vision. It has a sense of morality. It has a vision for what God wants in the world. And if you don't align yourself with that vision, then even though you're technically following the rules and you should get rewarded, there becomes an event horizon, if you will, that if you reach that point, you can't continue to exercise your own agenda. The closer you get to God, the harder it is to have your own agenda. So Og could have his own agenda when he's hanging around on the periphery of the Ark, when he's hanging on to the railing of the Ark. He could even have his own agenda when he came to Avraham to warn him about Lot. And he could get rewarded because he did a good thing, even though he didn't do it for the right reason. But once you get to Har Sinai, once you get to the mountain of Sinai, and you're so close to God, then you can't have your own agenda. Og tried to harness the power of Sinai because the Jews have sinned. And because the Jews were forced into it the first time anyway. But Og couldn't exercise his own volition when he was so close. But Og didn't want to back away. Og didn't want to back down. But Og couldn't get any further without actually doing what God wanted. And the classic example of that is when the Jewish people heard God's words at Har Sinai, the Medrash says that their souls flew up to heaven. They wanted to be so close to God. Og didn't want that. Og didn't want to go up to heaven. Og didn't want to be close to God. He just wanted to use God. He was a utilitarian. He used religion for his own benefit. And so Og was in a state of paralysis. He was paralyzed by Sinai. He wasn't crushed by it. He didn't want to back down, but he didn't want to go forward. And so Og was literally paralyzed by the mountain. And that's the symbolism of the Gemara, that the Gemara says that God made it that the mountain was lodged on his head, but it didn't kill him because Sinai couldn't kill Og. Rather, his teeth elongated. Why teeth is a bit of a longer explanation. There is an explanation, it's Kabbalistic, but the teeth, essentially, the part of the body that we use to parse information, that we use to break things down into their most core components, Og couldn't use. Og couldn't do that because he had his own agenda. And so he was paralyzed by it. He wasn't killed by it. He was paralyzed that now gave Moshe and the Jewish people the opportunity to kill him. Yes, Sherry, you're raising your hand.
All right, where do you get these interpretations of Og's who he really is, the so-called self-serving okay, monster, whatever you want to call him. But where do you get all these interpretations of his character to say that this happened the way it did? And I understand it's Midrash, but where do the interpretations of him come from?
So it's not on this source sheet. I'm happy to send you another one that's more comprehensive. This was just something that I could fit onto two pages. The Medrash that talks, or the source that talks about how Og had wanted to sort of keep Sarah for himself, that was a Medrash. It's the Bracious Rabbah. And the story about Og sort of surviving by holding on to the periphery of the Ark, that's in an earlier Medrash. It's the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. Once again, I'm happy to send this out to people on the email sheet. I'll send that out after the class. Yes.
Yeah, but I've heard of these sources. I mean, the books involved. But again, how does interpretation like that come out? How did they make these kind of interpretations, those particular ones, in fact? Because they're so, I don't even know the right word to use about it. Far out, maybe.
Okay, yeah. So it's an amazing question. It's a bit longer of an answer than what we can do in this class. But I guess the short version is that you are correct that there isn't so much.
The Cliff Notes version.
Yes, yes. So there isn't so much evidence in the text for it itself, and the Gemara, as I read earlier, acknowledges that. It says that there's no evidence for any of this stuff. And it says, Gemara Gemirila, that there is this tradition. Somehow, let me just scroll back up to it so you can see that. Here it is. So right on the beginning of source number one, the end of the first paragraph, it says, Gemara Gemirila. It was a tradition that was transmitted. Now, what exactly that was, it seems like that there was this general tendency to understand the character of Og based off of that. How that emerged is a much more amorphous question. It goes into the broader topic of how we look at people that live during the time of the Great Flood. It talks about, in the Torah, it talks about the Nephilim. It talks about the people that fell. Now, what that means, we don't really know. There are different interpretations. Some say they were giants, some say they were fallen angels. There are different interpretations, but basically there was this race of antediluvian people that mm-hmm. were either physically or politically much stronger than the average person. And there was some vestige of that that persisted even afterwards into the time when the Jewish people went into the land of Israel. Like a few weeks ago, we had in Parshas Shlach, we have the Anakim, we have these giants. So there seems to be this tendency to look at some type of people as giants.
The physically gigantic or otherwise gigantic, mentally, you know, again, there couldn't have been 20-foot tall people, but in a certain sense, to perhaps out of fear, they saw them as being bigger.
Yeah, so that's definitely an interpretation. In fact, there is there's a rabbi who passed away probably about 20 years ago. His name was Reb Gedalia Neidel. He was a student of the Chazon Ish, who was one of the greatest leaders of Haredi Judaism in the around the founding of the State of Israel. And one of his students, he had a lot of interaction with, I guess you could say, the more the Mizrahi or the Dati Lumi world, the religious Zionist world. So there's a small book that was published by Rav Shilat from Ma'ale Adumim. And it's about, I would say, half of it are lectures that he gave on Parshas Bereishis and Parshas Noach. It was put in Cheirim by certain groups in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel. And he actually advances a position that these Nephilim weren't necessarily giants. Rather, they were the ruling caste of society, the ruling class, and they were bigger, or they were giants in the sense that they could exercise political and financial power over the other people.
Again, that makes sense.
So again, that's one interpretation. There are many, but perhaps that's where it comes from. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so just going back now, taking a step back to Og. So Og tried to use that to his advantage, and he failed because he got too close to the Torah. He got too close to God that he couldn't exercise his own free will, but he didn't want to back down. And so what instead happened is not as a punishment, but as a natural consequence, he was paralyzed. And that enabled Moshe to kill Og. But now the question is that the Jewish people were guilty of the exact same thing that Og was, right? If we go back to that Gemara, the Gemara says that God put the mountain over their head. And he said, if you accept the Torah, great. And if not, I will crush you. So, okay. The Jewish people didn't seem to accept the Torah out of love for God or only out of love for God. Maybe they wanted to, but it seemed like there was an element of coercion. And in fact, the Gemara says that this was a moda'a rabba le'oraisa. This was a disgrace, as it were, to the Torah, that the Jewish people could have a complaint against God and could say, God, why are you punishing us for not keeping the Torah? We only accepted it out of force, and coercion is not a valid form of making a commitment. And they only accepted it upon themselves in its totality during the days of Purim. The Pasuk tells us in Megillas Esther, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, the Jewish people re-accepted upon themselves something. So what was that something? The Gemara says that they reaffirmed in exile their commitment to the Torah. But up until that point, certainly they accepted it, at least partially of their own free will. They said, Na'asev inishma, we will do and we will hear. That was not coerced, but there was an element of coercion. So how do we deal with that? So to answer that question, we have to go to the last part of the Medrash, the last part of the Gemara. The Gemara says that these insects, maybe ants, maybe grasshoppers, hollowed out the mountain. What is the symbolism in the hollowing out? So one of the commentaries to the Gemara, the Maharsha, his name was Rabbi Shmuel Edels, one of the very few rabbis to be known after their mother-in-law's name. Edel was his mother-in-law. He named the yeshiva and the commentary was known, and he was known as Shmuel Maharsha, Shmuel Edelson. It was his last name, because his mother-in-law not only supported him, but supported his entire yeshiva, which was basically the school system for the town. So because she had done such a great honor, because she had done such a great thing for the entire Jewish community and for him personally, he adopted her name as his last name. So he says that the mouth, he explains this based on verses, he says that the mouth of the insect symbolizes prayer. We use our mouth to talk to God. And so he says that prayer, the power of prayer or the phenomenon of prayer is what saved the Jewish people, is what allowed the Jewish people to be victorious over Og. And the, I guess, difference, as it were, between Og and the Jewish people was that Og didn't pray to God. The Jews prayed to God. Now, that in itself is a little bit difficult to understand because, and again, I guess there could be different answers to this, but what is the essence of prayer? There are different conceptions. If you look at various points in history, various religions, prayer does different things. People get different things out of prayer.
Bakasha.
I'm sorry?
Bakasha.
Yes, bakasha. So according to Judaism, the primary element of prayer is bakasha, is asking stuff from God. The Gemara tells us that the way that prayer is supposed to work and the way our Shemona Esrei is structured is that first we praise God, but we praise God as sort of a prelude or as a legitimization, or in halachic terminology, a matir, to permit ourselves to ask something from God. But the main point is asking God. And it's a little bit strange then, that also seems to be utilitarian. Prayer seems to be doing exactly what Og does. Og knew that if he wanted to be able to survive, to be able to obtain greatness, he needed to follow the rules. God is in charge of all of the flow of goodness in the world. So prayer is that too. We know that God has all the keys. God has the keys to all the treasure rooms. And so if we ask God nicely, maybe he'll answer us. Sometimes he answers us in ways we don't understand. But if we believe that he answers us, then how are we any better than Og? There has to be something else in prayer aside from the utilitarian aspect that distinguishes us. So that difference, I copied two sources from two 20th century rabbis. They both say essentially the same thing. One is an excerpt from Rav Soloveitchik, who writes it in English, and the second is from Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, who writes it in Hebrew. So we'll take a look at both. So source number three is it's something that Rav Soloveitchik, I don't know if he wrote it or he spoke about or this was a speech, but this was something that was collated in a book of Rav Soloveitchik on prayer known as Worship of the Heart. So I'm not going to read the whole thing just because we don't have so much time, but he talks about what prayer is. And he says prayer is a dialogue between the infinite and the finite, between human beings and an infinite God. God is the listener and man is the speaker. So now Rav Soloveitchik begins to editorialize. And I don't know if he was, I don't know what group he was referring to, whether he was referring to Jewish communities in the Orthodox world, in the non-Orthodox world, or perhaps even not other religions. He doesn't exactly say, but he says many contemporary conceptions of prayer service diminish it considerably due to a one-sided preoccupation with its hymnal and thanksgiving elements. Essentially saying that there are certain groups, he doesn't say whether they're Jewish, not Jewish, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, is there are certain groups that prioritize the praising and thanking God over the asking from God. And there seems to be a lot of sense in that, that you don't want to just be the guy that asks stuff from God. I forget who says it. It might be a Zohar, but it makes fun of people who on Rosh Hashanah just ask of stuff from God. It uses the language that they bark like dogs, like a dog pants. And so if you take the letters that vocalize the panting sound, it sounds like hav, 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 hav. So in Aramaic, that means give. And so it says on Rosh Hashanah, all these people ask stuff from God. They say hav, hav, hav. They bark like dogs. And instead, they should be praying for God. They should be praying for God's kingship. What that means for Rosh Hashanah is not for now. But I would have thought that thanking God and praising God is a good thing. But Rav Soloveitchik says that that's not the main point. The main point is asking things, is bakasha. Judaism vigorously disagreed with this elimination of petition. On the contrary, Judaism not only retained the so-called selfish prayer, but considers it the central theme of its service. Why is that? So let's go down to the final paragraph. The final paragraph says the reason for the centrality that Judaism has given the element of petition in the service lies in our philosophy of prayer. What's the reason for prayer? Avodah shebelev, worship of the heart, service of the heart, for all its tendency to express religious experience as a whole. Prayer encompasses the whole gamut of religious experience. And particularly its emotional aspect, prayer is emotional. It singles out one particular state of mind. For when we view the noetic content of prayer, we must admit that one emotion was central, namely the feeling of unqualified dependence. Rav Soloveitchik says that the main point of prayer is bakasha, is asking things for God, from God. But it's not that God has it and we want it. That's not the main point. The main point of asking is the emotional feeling of dependence that such asking creates. When we ask things from God, we feel a dependence on God. We need God. And it's that emotional component of our relationship with God that prayer serves. Prayer serves to get in touch with our need to depend on God. Yes, we need to ask to want. We need to ask in order to feel that. But the main point is not the getting or the needing to get, but it's the feeling of dependence on God that prayer catalyzes. Before I just take your question, let's just look at the final source. This is Rav Huttner. So Rav Huttner was a contemporary of Rav Soloveitchik, passed away a few years earlier. He grew up in White Russia, and he combined, I guess I would say, the Hasidic and non-Hasidic elements of Eastern Europe. He also went to Berlin. He may have overlapped with Rav Soloveitchik in university there. He took some, I think, either philosophy or psychology courses there. And eventually he made his way to America. And he was the Rosh Yeshiva. He was head of the Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn. And he published a set of discourses that he gave on the holidays. So on Rosh Hashanah, one of his discourses, he talks about prayer. So I'm going to read it in Hebrew and then translate it, just because the Hebrew prose is so beautiful. He says, "Hare tichuna shel tfila hu bakashat umilui tzrachav shel adam." The nature of prayer is that it is asking for humanity's needs. Nimtza, what emerges then, the af al gav de bichal ha'inyanim yichalto shel adam nimnit al tzad shlemuto. V'ilu tzrachav shel adam nimnim al tzad chesrono mikol makom b'inyan ha'tfila yicholet ha'amida lifnei ha'melech nizonet davka mi'chesrono. What that means is something fascinating. Rav Huttner says, if you take a look at the rest of Judaism, all of the commandments, all of the values that we have are of taking what we have and giving it to God or giving it to somebody else. It's using the resources that we have, whether it's ourselves, our bodies, our time, our money, our talents, using what we have to give away. Maybe to give to God, maybe to give to other people, maybe to give to a community. The more we have, the more we can give, the more we can do. The one exception to that is prayer. The less we have, the more intense our prayer becomes. Need and lacking is a totally different type of relationship, or it's a totally different side to our relationship with God. Just like in any relationship, there's a give and there's a take, so too with our relationship with God. We need to have a give and a take. So most of the time we give. God expects us to give a lot. We have 613 commandments. We have a lot to give to God, to give to other people, to give to the community. But there also needs to be a take. And that take is prayer. It's that feeling of need from God that completes and rounds out our relationship with him. And that, Rav Huttner says, is why we have prayer. It's not just to get it. The getting is an emtza'i. It's a medium through which we can round out our relationship with God, our relationship of taking, as opposed to our relationship with giving. Now that is what distinguishes us between Og and the Jewish people. That's what made us different from Og. Og saw prayer as purely transactional. He realized that God had everything, and if you want to get it, you need to do what God says. But he can have his own agenda. And that only works up to a point. The Jewish people, though, they also knew that God has everything. And they may have even acted out of self-interest at certain points, where there may, at the very least, have been an element of self-interest. But nevertheless, at a very, very fundamental level, the Jewish people wanted a relationship with God. And part of that relationship is a taking. And so, yes, we might ask God for things. We might act out of self-interest. But that is always based on this underlying drive that Jews have to develop a relationship with God, to make God's will our own will. And thus, our needs become his needs. And therefore, we have this give and take relationship that Og lacked. And so that's why the power of prayer was able to paralyze Og and allow Moshe to overcome him. And in a certain sense, that's what Bilam tried to do in this week's parsha as well. Bilam tried once again to harness the power of God against the Jewish people. And God said, no, it's not going to work. Why? Because Bilam himself said it in one of his blessings. We are God's favorite children. Utruat melech bo. We say that verse in the prayers on Rosh Hashanah, that it sounds a lot like the sound of a shofar, trua. But truat melech means the relationship, the favor of the king. We have a relationship with God. That is the key to the Jewish survival. Yes, there are times when we act out of self-interest. And God says that's supposed to happen. Not because you know that I have everything and you want to get it, but rather because you want to have a relationship with me. Prayer redeems, as it were, that selfishness, that element of selfishness that we all biologically have. Because now we have a relationship with God where we can both give and we can take. And that was the reason why Bilam could never overcome the Jewish people and why the Jewish people will always be blessed. I want to finish with two quotes. At the very bottom of the source sheet, there are two quotes. The first one on the left, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. I think it's a Charles Spurgeon. He was a 19th century English Baptist minister. And on the right is a quote from Rabbi Yaakov Tauber. He's a contemporary Chabad, Rabbi Chabad scholar. And they both have two different characterizations of prayer. So on the left, Charles Spurgeon, he says, true prayer is neither a mere mental exercise nor a vocal performance. It's not just thinking and it's not just singing. It is far deeper than that. It is a spiritual transaction with the Creator. So according to this, prayer is transactional. Og certainly thought that way. But it's also true that Jewish people believe that. We also believe that prayer is transactional. The difference is that we think that that transactional nature of prayer actually means something much deeper than that. If you look on the right, Rabbi Yaakov Tauber has a different characterization. He says, we pray because our soul is lonely. Eagerly, it awaits the time set aside for prayer. Those precious daily moments when the person it inhabits ceases to commune with the world and communes with his or her creator. So according to Rabbi Tauber, prayer is a time to talk with God. It's a time to hang out with God, to form a relationship with God. Og didn't see it that way. But as Jews, I think both of these perspectives are correct. According to Rav Soloveitchik, according to Rav Huttner, prayer is both elements. Prayer has a transactional component to it. We recognize that God has the things that we need, and we want them. And we ask him for it. And that's supposed to happen. We're supposed to daven. We're supposed to pray selfishly for them. But then we're supposed to take that a step further. We're supposed to use that sense of need, that sense of dependence on God, to form a relationship out of that. It's to form a relationship where we both give and take. If we just keep giving, if we just only do the mitzvos, where we give to God and we give to other people, that's one-sided. We need to feel that reliance and that connection to God the other way too, that we get stuff from God, and not just because God gives us stuff that's wonderful, but that's what it means to work together. When you work together, you complement each other. The entire book of Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, compares the life and the relationship of God with the Jewish people as a husband and wife. A husband and wife, a married couple, complement each other. They work together. And it's hard to understand it. But in a certain sense, God needs the Jewish people, and the Jewish people need God. And it's only by working together that our shared vision can come out, can emerge, can be successful. And so in order to have a unified relationship, we can't just give. We need to feel that reliance. We need to take as well. So this year has made our relationship with prayer evolve, at least for myself. A year ago, I wasn't davening in shul. I wasn't going to shul. I had just started going to a backyard minyan, a minyan in my backyard in Tina, where my parents lived. Some people had minyanim on porches. And some people didn't even leave their apartments. They didn't leave their houses for months on end. Prayer became a very, very, very personalized experience. And it also, I guess, was an opportunity to tap into that sense of dependence on God. We felt it quite poignantly these last 18 months. And now that we step back into shul, it's important that our prayer shouldn't just go back to the way it was 18 months ago. Just as we grow, our prayer is supposed to grow and evolve with us. But it doesn't just mean that we're supposed to just see prayer as a time to communicate with God. And it's not just a time to ask things from him. And it's not just a time to sing in praise for him. It's everything. It's all of that combined. When we come to shul or when we daven wherever, we're supposed to see it as an opportunity to tap into our relationship with God by asking him for things, by expressing both sides of that relationship, of what we can give and what we can take. Because when we have both of those elements, we're a team. And that's what prayer is. That's what davening is. Davening makes us a team with God. So I want to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos. If you come to shul this Shabbos and you hear Parshas and you hear Parshas Balak, maybe take a couple of seconds to think about this and to try to connect that to make your davening this week even more meaningful and even more profound. Once again, everybody should stay healthy. Everybody should stay safe. And I want to wish you a wonderful Shabbos. Yes.
What is noetic content or whatever the wording was that Soloveitchik used? What does noetic mean? Yes.
So I believe, let me just go back to it.
Yeah.
I believe that noetic.
Yeah, right. Noetic content of prayer.
Yes.
The bottom.
Yeah. So I believe, I don't know the exact definition. Let me just look it up.
Okay.
What the word noetic means or what it means here.
Yeah.
So noetic means that it's the way at least the dictionary defines it. It's relating to a mental activity. So I think what I believe that Rav Soloveitchik was driving at is that prayer is both an intellectual and an emotional experience.
Yeah.
And so an intellectual experience can have many different sides to it. Right. You can view or think about davening in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So the intellectual component of prayer is supposed to be fixated on this sense of dependence, this reliance on God, which mm-hmm. is then supposed to blossom into an emotional one.
All right.
Anyone else? Okay. All right. Wonderful seeing you all, and have a wonderful Shabbos.